Welcome to Engineering Success. I'm your host, Jamie Hutton, and in each episode we'll bring you an influential and inspiring guest from the world of engineering, science, technology and mathematics, sharing fascinating insights into their career journeys. We'll explore the challenges they face, how they keep motivated, and what the future holds for them. Speaking candidly about the engineering and other STEM-related industries, we'll find out what's made these successful people successful. This is Engineering Success. Welcome to episode number 26 of Engineering Success with Ayo Sokala. Ayo is a chartered civil engineer, a presenter and keynote speaker, ICE President's Future Leader, and ICE Superhero Eco Warrior. Ayo graduated with a Master's in Civil and Coastal Engineering from Plymouth University in 2016, and she is also a qualified project manager at the Environment Agency. Ayo is a supervising civil engineer, taking graduate engineers through the professional development process to achieve their professional qualification. She is an active member of her professional institution, the ICE, where she is a member of the ICE Thames Valley, ICE Policy and External Affairs, and ICE Communication Committees. Ayo was also nominated for the Top 50 Women in Engineering Under 35 initiative, run by The Telegraph, in partnership with the Women's Engineering Society. Hi Ayo, and welcome to Engineering Success. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
Hey Jamie, thank you for having me back. It's exciting to be back.
Brilliant to have you again. Can we start? How did you first find out about engineering? And then what led you to know this was a career that you wanted to pursue?
Oh, I decided I wanted to do engineering, I think, when I was 9 years old. I think I've spoken about this a little bit in the past.
Yeah.
So, I think very different perspective. I didn't stumble across it in terms of people finding it when they're much later in life. I kind of found out a lot earlier in life, growing up in Nigeria at the time, a developing nation, and you kind of see the impact of infrastructure on a higher scale, because obviously there's less infrastructure, so every new development makes more of a positive impact. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the kind of person who made a positive impact on the world. So that was when the idea of engineering joined my psyche. I think it was nine.
Right.
But obviously, I didn't just become an engineer at nine.
No.
Imagine I'm super
curious. Yeah, I know.
I then followed that up with, you know, work experience. And of course, I was conveying my interest to people. So even when I was at primary school, when I then moved back to this country, my maths teacher would give me extra work just to help me develop my skills. Then when I was in secondary school, I had a really good design technology teacher because I joined the after school club and I was there like every Thursday. So we'd do additional activities, stretching growing that skill set. And then she put me forward for a Women in Science and Engineering program at Imperial London College.
Okay.
I think I was in year nine, I think. Yeah. Because I'd done work experience already at different companies.
Okay.
Then that experience was a summer program and you did chemical engineering, electrical or aeronautical, like everything. So even some experience I hadn't gotten from going to like companies where I'd gone to a mechanical engineering company and done a bit of experience there, or I'd gone to a civil and structural company and done experience there.
It was
things that you wouldn't get experience of, like aeronautical engineering.
Right.
So it was really cool. But I still, by the end of it, knew, okay, I didn't want to do any of the other ones. I knew what I wanted to do.
So
I think I just carry that on and did the right kind of the traditionally appropriate GCSEs like triple science, design technology, and things like that. And obviously subjects I liked as well, like Spanish, geography, and then progressed to sixth form where I did also traditional A-levels
that you do
to be an engineer, like maths, further maths, physics, chemistry. And then I went to university. So I kind of followed the more traditional academic route. That's because I kind of knew what I was going to do so I could make those decisions earlier on.
There
are other ways to get into it. If you didn't know that you could become an engineer like in your 50s or like
Absolutely.
You do career changes.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
some of my, like one of the intake on my year of future leader scheme came in later on, like had a, had a previous career. So there's so many pathways to it. So that's just my one particular pathway.
Yeah. So your route was more traditional, wasn't it? To the university degree route, really.
Yeah, I went the traditional academic route, but there's so many other ways to engineering now. So let that not be a limiting factor.
No, absolutely not. So how do you think we can infuse the next generation of talent into our industry?
Oh, this is a question I get a lot. Yeah. And I think I'm developing a brand new thinking on it.
Okay.
So I'm going to test my new thinking, because I'm always the kind of person who believes we should always be developing and, you know, evolving and getting new knowledge and expanding that. So I'm going to test some of my new thinking. It's not quite finished yet, but I think the question shouldn't be really trying to enthuse people to come into our industry. We should have a good industry that speaks for itself. So deal with the systemic issues in our industry that make it not tenable for some people. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But firstly, I think when I coach people or I mentor them, the key thing I want them to do is do things they're good at, they enjoy, and have an inner navigator, that why, that they're following. Because Nietzsche says, if you know your why, you can live anyhow. So I don't want to convince you about my career, because at the end of the day, I'm an external person, and you know you more than anyone else knows you.
Absolutely,
and it's your job to know you. So find out what's good for you, what you'll enjoy, get work experience and lots of things, try lots of things. But know yourself and follow the path that suits you. So that's the first thing. So I don't want to enthuse you or like radicalize you to be an engineer, because you might join it and absolutely hate it.
Absolutely.
And I don't want you to hate it. I want you to do what you'll love and where you'll thrive. And then there's that secondary bit I've kind of hit on the head, like make our industry speak for itself. You know, there are challenges in our industry and we have to deal with them to make it appealing. You know, when you do those census forms, it says, are you the first in your family to go to university? Do your parents have a traditional professional job? Traditional professional jobs historically were engineers, lawyer, doctor. Now, if you compare engineering now to our counterparts in law and in medicine, we don't compete, not in starting salaries, not in, we don't have unions that work on our behalf. So there's no one to protect us in that way. And then also we have this industry that, you know, we've seen that with Carillion. We have these contracts that kind of push down, but we get the cheapest price. So it means there's not enough money in it to push for people's development and growth. And that just damages the industry. And we only have like a few mega clients and consultancies that like four of them really that get on these mega frameworks. They're owned by, like, it's just that monopolization of like this. It's just not good for business. You look at it, you know, I think historically they used to ban like one company owning everything. But we have that in our industry where it's like four consultancies.
Absolutely.
Really,
playing
the game. So that doesn't help engineers when it comes to either lobbying for better work conditions, better salaries, or better, you know, better focus on their development, exciting work. So I think that unless you deal with those things, I don't think it will speak for itself. And to be fair, being an engineer and the subjects you have to study to get here, if you follow the traditional approach, but even if you follow the apprenticeship approach, it's a challenging industry.
It's something that's, you know,
there's only probably X proportion of the population who maybe would find it something they could do intellectually, they could stretch themselves to do. And out of that proportion, they might want to do something that pays them more, because we don't compete when it comes to salary.
Absolutely.
And we can't say that doesn't matter, because historically, the only jobs that are really cool that people are willing to do for poor pay is because it's the job itself is so exciting. I don't know, like, you know, like, I don't know. There's some jobs that are like super, super compelling,
but often
they don't pay very well, but then maybe they open doors long-term for the people and they can do amazing things with it.
Yeah.
But our industry isn't like that, to be honest.
No.
So, you know, it's someone probably sits, if you're a design engineer on a graduate scheme, you know, you're born of a food chain, you sit there for hours and hours a week, you have to do external hours of CPD for professional qualification to ever move up salary grade.
Yeah.
Those challenges that just haven't been dealt with. And therefore, that isn't a compelling case, and it doesn't compete if you have X amount of the population that have the potential, either determination or the intellectual potential to stretch themselves to do the academic ways, BTEC, apprenticeships. They might pick more compelling industries that pay them more.
And then
you have to consider the society you live in. You know, the cost of living increases, et cetera, the external pressures.
Yeah,
people
yeah,
will make
yeah.
better decisions. you look at student loans, the interest rates on that, all the things that happen in the external, like, I don't know if you do this PESTL analysis, the drivers make you pick the most compelling choice. Now, we are not a compelling choice. And it isn't the job of someone trying to look into our industry to make it compelling. It's our job to pay slightly higher starting salaries that match the cost of living. To put time into people's day jobs to do their development so that people aren't going outside working else to do that, because that burns people out. People need time to recuperate, to have space. And we know that all creativity and real thinking happens in the downtime. Best ideas come in the shower. We need to do that.
Absolutely.
We need to have a union that looks after us, and we need to have a lot of things put in place. But they're clear actions we can take as an industry. You know, Project 13 started on some of these things. So, you know, well, particularly on the contracting things, to make sure that the contracts weren't just like the lowest price. So they're clear actions that we could take as an industry to make ourselves more compelling. But it's not about the individual trying to come in, and it's not about, you know, some going into school and saying about engineering, because we've done that for at least the last half a decade at least 10 years. You're seeing that increase in you know, STEM ambassadors, people going into schools, and people seeing that engineers can be all kinds of people. But if people come down to and say, I need to study a 5-year degree or do a 10-year apprenticeship if I need qualify, you know, to get a fully accredited as a chartered engineer or whatever, and that pays less than the duty manager role at my local Tesco's, they might rethink it. It has to be economically compelling, it has to be time compelling, it has to be all those things. And of course it can be exciting, but you know, most people know most jobs are full of a lot of monotony. It's not just the exciting bits when something's on site and built. So
Lots of
things we could do as an industry.
That's a great answer. And following on for that, you know, I know you're heavily involved with the ICE, the Institute for Civil Engineers. Do you think that the professional institutions in engineering are doing enough to help promote it, to make it that better place to work? Or do you think that there's so much more room for improvement?
So I'm an active member of the Institution of Civil Engineers, and they do a lot when it comes to showing invisible superheroes and showing the invisible work of engineers.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because that's one part of the issue, right?
Absolutely.
For example, like I said earlier, when you compare to law and medicine, we don't even have that economic state. It's not just economic status. We don't have that status in terms of like professionalism.
Yeah.
Lawyers are respected, doctors are respected, engineers are not. So in some ways, they've done a really huge job in trying to raise the profile of engineering.
Yeah.
Make it more something that's respected, which, you know, it's a huge thing, because, you know, people make a lot of egoic decisions, and people want something that aligns with their ego.
Absolutely.
And if you're smart and you're going to do something hard, then you want something that people in society will validate you for.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of human drivers. So they're doing that work to make the case for engineering being important, the meaning of what we do.
Yeah.
You know, we protect, for me, I'm eco-angel.
I protect
homes from flooding.
Yes.
And that's super compelling in terms of a job that has a meaning. And that's part of the work that needs to be done, but it isn't all of the work that needs
Absolutely.
To be done.
Yeah.
And the institution isn't the union, of course. That's not its body. It's a thing that helps. They write papers. They help, you know, inform government, but they themselves are not a union. So maybe we need something like that that does that little bit of work. And I know they do things like the benevolent fund to help people who are struggling, it's still not a union. And I think maybe you need a union to advocate for all our rights, for pushing our salaries up, for especially in the early part of the people's careers.
Yes.
Because I think that's where people really struggle. And I know that maybe when you're a principal engineer, I don't know, 10, 15 years into your career, then that's a different case. But also based on company hierarchies, there's only so many of these roles anyway. So if you employ, I don't know, 100,000 people, there's 10 of those people across.
Yeah.
So even then, the average salary needs to go up to reflect the responsibility in the work. And maybe that's what a union would help us do, but we don't have that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the place of the professional institution, because that puts it in a political position, and it has to almost maintain political neutrality to be able to have that access it does with, you know, Westminster. So we do need probably something else, but maybe something like the IC could help another organization in doing that, or we could do that.
It's like,
I think we do need, because, you know, but I would say the IC has done well on starting Project 13, on trying to improve, you know, the quality element and the development element. But you know, till you have a way of holding other companies and the consultancies to account, yeah. till you have time built into contracts for people to develop on a job, till you have people challenge the, I think is, okay, on one note, we say that our industry tends to run behind program, go over budget, but also we live in a chronic deadline state.
Yes.
And often those deadlines are political. They come not from us.
Yeah,
and if we were to advise at the very start of a project, we wouldn't give those deadlines. So in some senses, you know, a lot of the things that set us up for failure are not in our hands. And that is something that needs to be either communicated clearly so that, you know, people have a different perspective on things. And that is also more encouraging for people in the industry to stay in the industry. Because it isn't just about getting people into the industry, it's about retaining them. And I think we also struggle with that.
Absolutely.
And I've seen that as well when people just leave to do other things.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think, you know, I was at a talk, I think, 18 months ago. I don't know. Time's very hard in the pandemic times.
Yeah.
But it was an ICE talk. It's a very fascinating talk. And one of the speakers is ex-military, and he was saying we don't address the fact that he deemed our careers in engineering to be more stressful than his career when it came to the military.
Right.
Because in the military, it's addressed that you weren't under stress. You're talking about the stress associated with that. You aren't just acting like it's, you know, business as usual. But
we
live with constant deadline status. If you're a project manager, it's deadline status.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you are the designer, some client or some political person puts a deadline and someone comes to you and said, you need to get all those design drawings in 3 days' time.
Yeah,
and
so,
you know, we don't talk about that. And it's that chronic stress. The deadlines are always super important. Everything we do is super important.
Yes.
And that chronic stress as well, it's just not something that can be maintained by people. And either people disengage from doing the additional stuff that we think will be useful. For example, if you're just working super hard on deadlines and working really late, you're not going to want to do STEM outreach, are you?
No.
So, like, do you know what I mean? So,
absolutely.
It's not embedded. Do you know what I mean? So you can't showcase what you do, even if it's really exciting. And they are compelling parts of it. It's just so exhausting.
Absolutely.
I think there are a lot of systemic things that could improve. I don't think they all fall on the institution's door because it has that tight rope. Type line, I think, to walk
I get in being able
to influence and staying politically neutral. So maybe this is where we need actual unionized action. But I think I'm starting to sound like a Labour politician here. There's a reason why unions are a good idea.
Do you think the institutions would support that sort of an idea?
Well, I don't know. I really don't. I think I know what the institution would do when it comes to things like improving consultancies and their power and things like that, because it's clear because they've taken other actions that can show me what their thoughts are on that. But I've never seen any document about unions before. I don't even think it's something I've ever had a conversation on any of the committees I've been a part of. So I don't have anything to base an opinion on that.
Right,
so without any evidence, I just wouldn't be able to, I would literally be speculating. There's some things that you can see where the IC stands on, like Project 13 or its briefing paper post-Carillion, because obviously wants to improve the industry.
Absolutely.
But
something
when it comes to unions, I have not seen anything pertaining to that anywhere.
Right.
So I couldn't say.
Right. Okay. So we know it's important to enthuse the next generation of talent. And it's also important that they understand the challenges that we all face. How do you think that's best explained? And, you know, like, for example, the innovation in engineering and, you know, the net zero, because it's all quite hard to understand, isn't it?
I think we just have to be honest. And I think we need to speak the whole truth. I think so often when we package engineering to be compelling to young people or to young adults, it's a part of the truth. And I think to really, really shape reality and change reality, you have to accept and see reality, which means you have to talk about all parts of the truth and all the nuance. So I think it's about having better conversations. And this isn't just in engineering. I think all parts of the world could do with this. We don't have the best dialogues. And that means we never solve the right problems because we don't understand them.
Yeah.
So in that case, you know, 48% of carbon in the UK comes from construction. Like that's a fact. But then when it comes to my field in water and flood risk management, if we don't do the work we do building, you know, flood defences and flood barriers, you're going to be flooded.
Absolutely.
I mean, the Thames Barrier protects 1.25 million people from flooding. Yeah. That has carbon required to build it and maintain that asset. You know, we need to understand about those balancing acts and where we can find innovation and where we can find new ways of working. But we also need to create a culture that is pro-innovation. And I know we have hindrances to that as well, because, you know, and this comes back to contracts, I think, a little bit, because, for example, the consultant doesn't want to take a risk, because if they do something that isn't already standardized, a British standard or a Eurocode or approved code of practice or a best practice method, then if there's anything that happens, that professional liability says they haven't done the right thing. But we want innovation and we need innovation.
Absolutely.
So how do you balance that contractual relationship with the desire for innovation? It isn't about an individual or some young graduate coming into the industry with a, I would have said in the past, get the more different people you have in the room, the better. But actually, no, that is only part of it, because even if that one person sits in the room and they've got a brilliant idea, the contract maybe doesn't facilitate that and the process doesn't facilitate that. Because if they designed this, that same bridge, they'll pick up the old spreadsheet they used for that similar project because there's an efficiency in using that work, and they'll build on that again. But it doesn't necessarily deal with the challenges or the nuances or the constraints or the particular efficiencies and innovations that we found if you take a different perspective, because it doesn't allow for that in the contract. It's too costly.
That's right.
It's too risky. And we're quite risk averse. So because we don't have the right risk appetite, because what we do obviously affects people's lives. We build buildings, we build railways, like everything we do. So if we mess up, it's so high risk. Of course we have that nervousness, and then coupled with the contractual elements, it doesn't facilitate innovation. So I don't know how to balance that, to be fair. I think there are lots of people who are way more expert when it comes to procurement than me who are having these conversations. And it's a challenge, and it's not a simple solution. So that's why I don't think we solved it, because, you know, when it comes to fixing problems, we pick the easy problems so we can get some easy wins to get that momentum started. And then we get on the list and we get to the hardest stuff and we're scratching our heads a little.
because
multifaceted challenges. It's procurement, it's a culture of innovation, it's collaborating, but also intellectual property. It's okay, you want people to be different, have different ideas, but obviously in any system, systems are built to maintain themselves and to stay the same. Systems are created to have the status quo. Your body works as this whole brilliant system to maintain the status quo. That's what all systems do. And anything that comes into it, the body treats it as an attack and it tries to get rid of that virus. So the same way you have a new person, a new innovative thinking, it's a disruptive idea. And those industries either fall apart because they can't tackle or meet that new innovation or disruption. Hence, you know, Uber versus taxi companies. We see this. Disruption is something that we systems don't do well to handle. But innovation is a disruption of a kind.
It is,
of course. We need it, but it's hard to facilitate in a system that its job is built to maintain that status quo for consistency, for stability. And obviously you can't have like a Jacobs or a Atkins or a Mott, and I'm just picking any random company, constantly pushing itself to innovation to the point where it has no stability. People wouldn't have jobs. They'd be getting hired and fired based on each contract success. You know, it's good to say we have innovation, but there is that challenge there. And I hate to, you know, speak about a problem without having a solution, but I also think it's really important to define the challenge. And I'm going to process of defining the challenge so I can understand maybe where my contribution could be in making that better. I haven't got there yet, but like I say, self-development and growing is a journey.
There's
never really an end date.
No, there isn't. You're right there. So what myths would you like to dispel about engineering?
What myths would I like to dispel about engineering? I've spoken about this in the past. I've said some things, I've been in articles and so on about engineering can be for everyone, but I also want to correct my previous thoughts, because I don't think it is for everyone, to be fair. I don't think everyone would enjoy it. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I've always said there's a pathway for everyone in every industry, and in some sense there could be. So maybe I'm adding further nuance to my points that I've said in previous articles. This is an addendum. See further. You know, the myth in the past is that there's only one type of engineer, right? That's what I've spoken about, that it can only be X, Y, Z person.
Yeah.
And I've spoken about the fact that there's several careers you can have in engineering, for example. I'm a chartered civil engineer, but I'm also a qualified project manager, and I mostly deliver projects and I manage budgets and I do all of these kind of things that are they're not just pure engineering anymore. Yeah. They're not the stuff I did as a graduate when I was doing all the design calculations.
Absolutely.
So in that sense, my previous myth that engineering can be varied is true, but I've also said that engineering can be for everyone. And I think if you don't like, you know, this is one of the things, if you don't like waiting 10 years for a massive mega project to be delivered and you like to see change yesterday, you might find yourself a little frustrated. So that's an honest answer.
I think it
goes back to knowing yourself. Like I always say to people, do your Myers-Briggs, do your 5 strengths, ask your friends and family, like, what are the 5 things you know about me that I'm good at? And then start picking your career around those strengths.
It's a good idea.
At the end of the day, when you know yourself, you might find that, you know, what's required in the various roles in engineering doesn't suit you.
That's
not a bad thing, because you might have an amazing contribution to give in medicine. Or, you know, you might be the person who improves logistics of a council's garbage removal that saves people, you know, can reduce their council tax. I don't know. And that's all fantastic. So I want people to find the place that they can have the most benefit, but also enjoy it. So, I don't think engineering is for everyone. I think it's for people who want to do it. And even then, you might find you might face challenges, as is the nature of the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So have you had any mentors that have helped you and continue to help you along your journey?
Yeah, I've had so many mentors. My first mega mentor was doing the IC Future Leader Scheme, and Lord Robert Mayer was my mentor. And I think mentors are great. One thing, they raise your aspirations. I say this all the time. Sometimes, for example, you have one desire. Like when I left university, I just want to be a chartered engineer. That's my only objective, right?
Yeah.
But then I do the program and, you know, I'm on In Plain Sight, which is looking at reducing the risk of infrastructure failure. And that's super important. It's mega important to society. And now I'm like, oh, I can do that as well. And then that gives me a taste of policy. And I'm like, oh, then I become a counselor and that helps feed that. But those desires don't come till you already get exposure to another thing.
That's right.
So that's what mentors give you. They raise your aspirations because they often give you exposure to realms that you wouldn't naturally, organically, at least in that phase of your career, get exposure to. And then that gives you an appetite for something more, you know?
Yeah, like absolutely.
I did the ICE Bazalgette video, and then I discovered I just love presenting about engineering and science and STEM, and my natural personality is a really good fit to that. Yeah. So sometimes that gives you the appetite to want to pursue a new thing. So that's what mentoring can give you. It raises your aspirations, it opens your eyes to new possibilities, and then you can follow those possibilities. And on that journey of pursuing these new dreams, new goals, new objectives, you then become something else. You gain new skills, you become a different person. And that's exciting, because then who doesn't want to know what them at their maximum potential could look like?
Absolutely.
I mean, I always want to know. I haven't seen her yet. So that's the journey, you know. You'll never really catch up with that, because you'll constantly be developing, and then there'll be a new design, something ahead of you. And that's what mentoring has done for me. And that's what I give to other people when I mentor them. I'm like, have you considered this? Or I'll even point out their strengths, things that they haven't themselves identified in themselves. Yeah. And through that, they can then grow that. So I think at any phase of your career, you can be mentored and mentor other people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I also do reverse mentoring. I mentor a director. It gives you all these really different perspectives.
Yes.
And that's all I think everyone should be trying to gain. Expand their perspective as much
Absolutely.
As possible, because that's where growth happens.
Yeah.
But I will caveat it that trust your own instincts. You know yourself. And if you have a mentor relationship and they're helping with your technical perspective as an engineer, they may not know all the various challenges you face, all the things that make things doing exactly what they've done impossible for you. So I think it's really important that you acknowledge your own strengths and who you are.
That's
and
right.
You don't devalue yourself in the need to be like the person who's mentoring you. You're not trying to replicate their journey, because obviously that's not really possible, and you'd be a very second-rate version of them.
Absolutely.
But you could be a first-rate version of yourself. So
caveat
that with really trusting your own judgment. You know the full picture that you may not convey to other people.
Yeah.
And you may not tell everyone all the different parts of your life in that mentoring. They might say, you know, you want to do 15 extra hours of CPD a week, and you might have three kids under two, and that's just not possible.
You know
your life, you know the constraints, so really trust yourself as well.
So who or what do you think's been your biggest inspiration?
Honestly, I think my own family. No one in engineering, really. No offense. I was always inspired by what engineers could do. No particular engineer inspired me. Of course, till I learned about Battlejack, I found him inspiring. And I also found it inspiring when he had a, this sounds kind of controversial, but he had a breakdown in his career because he obviously overworked himself. He was traveling all across the country on horseback. You know, at the olden days, engineers had to fund their own projects. He was dealing with all the challenges a project manager would deal with while being a technical engineer and dealing with the increased health and safety risks. And what I loved about it is he was a human person. And because of that, he had a breakdown. And I know that doesn't sound inspirational, but it's important to remember that we're human beings.
And when
we look at these great giants or titans in history, that's the bit that I don't often wax lyrical about is their breakdowns, their humanity. But we're humans. And if we work, you know, 70 to 90 hour weeks, I can be a good example of it. After 3 months, 4 months on the line, you might get really sick, you might break down. And that's really important to acknowledge. So that's an example of what I really, I mean, I love Battlejack for doing what he did on the London Sears and having that impact, but I also love that human bit about him. Which people don't ever talk about. So that's something that inspires me in some sense, you know, that holistic humanity. But really, when I was a kid, before I really knew about specific role models in engineering like William Degan or Battlejack, it was my parents.
Right.
They're just hardworking people who not only do their job, but they go out of their way to help people. My mum would always do charity work. I think that's what I got so involved in.
As
a teenager, doing my own charity events because my mum just made it as normal.
As people
I didn't even think it was anomalous till I got older. People were like, really? At that age? I was like, these are not just what people do. Like, they just volunteer and they help people and they like invite people around to their house and they do and they help people and they like give whatever resources they have. I wouldn't think anything of it because my family normalized being that kind of person. So in so many sense, actually, even though my parents aren't engineers, they inspire me to have an engineer's heart because engineers are people who solve problems and they help people. And my dad's a doctor, he helps people that way. My mom's a social worker, she helps people that way. They found ways to use their skills, knowledge, experience, and the things that they're naturally good at to make the world a better place. And I think that's what all of us are trying to do. And I like to be biased that only engineers do that on a major scale, but really, we can all do that, whichever tools we use to do it. So I think they're the people that inspire me the most. And my grandmother, because she was the person who probably got me into reading so much. Obsessed with reading as a kid because my grandmother was into reading and I used to read all her books and she probably helped me out quite a lot because I'm very dyslexic, but because we were just reading all the time that became like a superpower, being able to read and learn quickly, even though actually it's something that I find, you know, quite naturally I have some challenges with. So my grandmother and my parents and Battlejack and William Degas. And not in any of that order. My parents come first, my grandmother.
Absolutely.
That's a very scattergorical
answer. It was.
I'm a very scattergorical person.
It was a very good answer. So why do you feel there's been such a skill shortage within the engineering industry?
I think there's been loads of conversations around this. I'm not quite sure what the full answer is. I list a couple of things I read in articles. I think there's some things that people say, you know, we had the last huge economic crisis. And I think a lot of companies just got rid of everyone. So we lost a lot of middle grade professional engineers. And I think we end up maybe keeping some of the senior people. And then obviously then people left university, didn't have jobs to go to. So I think for a while, our industry just wasn't bringing new graduates, new blood in. Because I think the construction industry is most affected by economic crises. So for that duration post, I know, that last economic crisis, there wasn't an intake of new graduates. And then you lost a lot of middle professionals. And then now I think we're getting more investment back into construction with the whole leveling up agenda. But obviously, when you cull a huge part of the workforce and they've gone out elsewhere, you lose that skill. And I think you lose that technical expertise, you lose a lot of knowledge that leaves the industry immediately.
Yeah.
So also now you have gaps, and we're only catching up from that economic crisis, I think, will be one key reason that I read that I truly believe to have left this kind of impact on our industry.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, we're seeing more people study STEM subjects. So long term, I don't know, maybe things will be better, but it just, we have to be in a compelling industry. And it's not just about what's going on out there. We just have to show up and look on the hierarchy like a good industry.
Yeah, yeah.
In anticipation for this podcast and this interview, I Googled top paying jobs. We're not on it.
Really?
But if you go in the US, engineering, civil engineering does come up on their top 20.
Right, okay.
We're not on it. And, you know, for quite a tough degree, if you Google that, what's the total degree?
It's not
the
really
math isn't
is
mathing, as they would say on TikTok. The math isn't mathing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So, you know, effort equals reward. That effort is not equal to that reward. So I think, obviously, you have the economic crisis to blame some of the issues. But I think right now, the math isn't mathing. If you are a young person trying to embark on your life and you want a life that's comfortable, you don't want every time some big business increases the cost of living on shops, you know, cost of your grocery shop increases. I don't know if anyone saw this, the April, the cost of their phone contracts increase, the cost of electricity and gas increase. Yeah. If you've gone to university, the cost of your student loan increase. People are making different decisions, are making economic decisions, as they should, to be fair.
Yeah.
Because I was on another podcast, the Unbiased podcast. It's a financial podcast.
Right.
And it's really interesting because it's talking about equality between the genders, sex, whichever one you want to use in this point. I think this argument is the same for both of those definitions, sex and gender. That only happens when you have financial equality and financial parity.
Right.
So ironically, we're trying to push more women to come into STEM, but because it pays, or engineering specifically in this conversation, but because it doesn't pay so well, actually economic parity would be encouraging a young woman to go into law. And invest so that she, you know, with the retirement age or people not really get to trust the government is ever going to really provide any retirement fund for them, you know, with the rising population, the aging population, and then the, you know, the kind of declining population because there is no system to help people have children and pay for their cost of nursery, etc. And it sounds like I'm going categorical, but that's the thing. We sit in holistic systems, and systems affect systems, as Jim Hall from Oxford University says. We have to have a system and system approach to things. Yeah. And we're talking about engineering and appealing to people in a silo. And it's like, well, all of that stuff is happening. People are making very sensible decisions.
Yes,
and, you know, this career is always quite stressful or busy. And if you could get paid more and do less, well, why wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Exactly. And if you want gender or sex inequality, and we're seeing the studies that, you know, this industry doesn't pay as well, then I wouldn't encourage a young woman trying to make sure that she can make the same decisions. Is that the right choice? I don't know. But all
it's
this
difficult,
is it,
isn't
really?
It? Yeah, it's difficult.
And there's an interesting study I was reading as well about in a lot of I don't know how to put this most appropriately, and I don't want to misquote the research. That's a problem when you read a bazillion articles and it's always jammed up in your mind. But it was talking about in some countries, I don't know, like Middle Eastern countries, there's a lot of women studying STEM, a lot of women doing PhDs, but also those careers are almost, they're leeching men because they don't pay well. And men in those countries often still play a traditional masculine role in providing.
So even
that was interesting. And this is just another tangent maybe, but if more women come into STEM, will STEM even be paid even less? Because historically, because of the devaluation of things that women do, for example, there are more women primary school teachers don't get paid very well. Head teachers get paid well, but there's not very many women, even though that most of the primary school teachers are women, but primary school head teachers are men, and that gets paid really well. The massive jump up. So we have a cultural issue to talk about as well, and it seems like it's unrelated, but I think everything is related. And maybe this is the way my neurodivergent mind works. I like to link patterns between all the data and all
the
things.
Yeah, of course.
And often there are patterns between them because systems exist interlinked.
Yeah.
And this is a system that's interlinked. So we want to get more women to STEM, more diverse people to STEM. But let's look, you know, Larry Elder, I don't know what the perspective on that research is, but it's an interesting perspective. It's from the US and talks about race and how if you want Black people to do better in the US, they need to do better economically.
Right.
And it's actually, he talks about a very interesting perspective that to do better in any system, you don't need political power, you need economic power. And right. then from economic power comes political power and comes real change. If our industry doesn't pay as well, then and you want to then increase diversity into it long term, will this industry pay even less? And will those people then actually be more disempowered?
Yeah.
I mean, that's my thinking. You know, I like to go on that edge, link everything together and see how a thought evolves. But you know, these are things we need to consider. We can't think about things inside.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right because
could we actually have a negative impact by getting more women in STEM? Controversial.
I'm not saying
that should be the case, but if you are making a case for these things, you have to consider these things. Yeah. And then there's this other interesting perspective because I mean, let's say you study a standard 5-year degree with a sandwich year, and you leave school at 18 and you go to study that 23, and the average duration for chartership is 5 to 7 years. I think. Five is the average. You were 30. That's like normally when women have children. So there's loads of these things.
There's lots of factors.
And if you then go out of industry, coming back, we're trying to come up with things to help women get back into the world. But there are loads of factors that just have to be considered in general. Yeah. And you can't have these conversations without considering all the factors and all the constraints.
Absolutely.
It's like writing a design brief, but not considering the soil conditions or the water. So it might sound categorical and unrelated, but like Jim Hall says, systems approach, you have to consider all the constraints.
Yeah, there's a lot of things involved, isn't it? It's not as simple as sometimes we would like it to be, is it?
It's not just about getting, you know, more role models. I think that's what I keep hearing in every single zeitgeist conversation in this space.
Yeah,
that's great, but that's only half the battle. If that role model was taking on all the labor, if that role model was underpaid, if that role model is devalued, if they're doing more labor that isn't valued, then the question and the answer is never to do more of something that things that people don't value.
It's a very good point. Yeah. So after all that, what would your number one piece of advice be for someone coming to engineering, apart from don't come?
I did not say that.
No,
nothing I said was
I was
very
just
fun.
Putting words in your mouth.
Oh, God. I hope that's not what anyone's got out of this podcast.
No, I was joking.
I just
joking.
Think we have to be honest and we have to make sure that we are, I mean, we go into schools all the time. We sell. Engineering is a really well-paid career. On average, it's not. So a lot of the standard slides I've seen people go into schools with, half of that's a lie. So all I want is the truth to be the truth because I value the truth.
Yeah,
I think the truth's important. I think the whole truth is important. I think nuance is important. And I think people should make decisions with all the facts. I don't want people to be hoodwinked.
Yeah.
And because I want a society where everyone can reach their zenith potential and contribute to make our society the best it can be. And an artist may not be meant to have a career in engineering because it might be too constrained in the way that our systems work.
Yeah.
So it's about everyone going to the place where they can have their most potential maximized, but in a way that's enjoyable as well. Because I don't want to be like productivity tyrannicalness or tyrant, but you know, we have those issues. We look at the Transforming Infrastructure Performance Report. We are not the most productive country but we could improve. We maybe had systems change, but I think that's also factored by having people who enjoy it, or maybe they're at work because they're not stressed about lots of other factors.
If you
considered that in the whole package of the industry, then you could take the stress of those people and they could show up as their best selves. So that's something you do people already in industry, but people who are on the outside looking in, I want you to know the facts. So when you embark in this, you are sitting in that meeting knowing this is a decision I've made. I know my why, and therefore the how of living this process and this industry is acceptable and amenable to me. And in accepting all of these things and seeing all of reality and knowing all the constraints, I can then design something better with a full, robust design input statement of all the constraints. That is what I want. So I'm not trying to put you off. I just want you to think about this in the most holistic sense. And I want the best for everyone.
And
that doesn't always mean doing what I do. It means doing what's best for you.
Absolutely.
So, if you're meant to be an engineer, be an engineer. If you want to be a civil engineer and all of this sounds fantastic, go do it. Go do some work experience, go look into it.
Yeah,
And there are loads of different things. Go look into all the different roles that could be in industry. Look at if you want to be structural, water, highways, and then whatever hits your fancy and tickles you and gets you so energized, follow that. Yeah. Follow that passion.
Yeah, that's great. So as you've alluded to, you know, we continually develop as engineers, continually grow. You know, for me, engineering is a lifelong learning career. How do you? I know you do an awful lot of work, but how do you develop yourself professionally?
Well, I want to go back to the ICU because every single member, even the graduate member, you have to have a development action plan.
Yeah,
I have one for my general life in all the different facets of it, but in my professional life, I have the things that I want to achieve next in my career.
Right.
So that might mean those things might mean I have to gain new skills, new knowledge, new experience, and then I need to make a plan for that. So I use my DAP in all the parts of my life, but when it comes to my professional life, let's say I want to go for XYZ role in the next, I don't know, 10 years, and that means I have to do this role first and this role first. I can map what that requires. There's, you can go into the job role profiles, pick the skills that requires, then go see how do I get the experience for that. So, you know, be proactive, use your DAP as a tool for yourself, not just to have the record because the IC requires it.
Don't just
do the bare minimum. Actually utilize these tools for yourself. And when you do, and you make these plans and you have a sense of what you want to achieve, even if your objectives change throughout it, the person you become by doing the development that you've highlighted for yourself, that's exciting. So let's say you want to be, I don't know, CEO of your organization. I don't know. And I don't know, you're a graduate. You might map what the next step is, chartership. Yeah. And you might need to get design experience, site experience. So you'll go and find out where that experience comes from. You'll know exactly what attributes need to be hit. And to get those attributes, you might need to do XYZ piece of work. And then you will do it. And in doing that, you will develop. So that's why those DAPs are tools, not just for your chartership and the start of your career, but for your whole career.
And to be
fair, you can use that model for everything. For example, if you want to learn a new language or you want to be more competent in something in your personal life, these are tools that I think everyone can use. I use them all the time. I'm very excited about them. You can't tell.
I can tell.
I'm obsessed by development. I get excited by the idea that tomorrow you can be even greater than today.
Absolutely.
And obviously that we are masterpieces and work in progress simultaneously. So you're excited by who you are and you accept who you are, but you're also like, what if I did this and I became more competent and I learned this and I spoke another language and like what happens then? How exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And finally, you know, looking forward, what does the future hold for you?
Well, that would be telling, wouldn't it?
Well, I'd like you to tell.
No, honestly, the future looks like someone who's doing all the things they love, showing up authentically and growing continuously. And that could mean lots of different things. I have an idea about what those things might look like, but as I go on the journey and taking the actions required to plug in the skills gaps or the knowledge gaps or the experience gaps, I might become someone new and find a new desire. So who knows what it'll look like
that's
in the future.
A great answer.
But I'm sure going to enjoy the journey. And that's something that I think I've learned more over time. I think in our last podcast, I was like, you should enjoy the journey, but I don't enjoy the journey. I really don't. I like the outcomes. And now I'm very much understanding the journeys most of our life. So if you don't want to wish away your life, you might want to look at enjoying the journey and the process.
I'm
doing things that I enjoy.
Yeah.
Well, who knows where that will manifest in me being or what roles that will look like, but it will sure be having a very good time, be hyperactive and categorical and authentic while doing it.
Ben, that's a brilliant answer. Ayo, thank you very much for being on the show today. It's been brilliant to speak to you.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been such good fun coming back again.
Okay, thank you for listening to episode number 27 of Engineering Success with our very special guest, Ayo Sakala. It was great to catch up with Ayo again. She gives so much time to promote STEM in her outreach work and working closely with the ICE.
and please follow IO's journey. All her links can be found on her podcast webpage. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to share it with someone you feel would benefit from listening to it. You can share it on Instagram or Twitter, and please leave a comment or a rating if you can. Also, subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. We've got more amazing guests coming soon. So until the next episode, have a great day, and I hope you succeed in all you do.